Welcome to NeuroNoodles Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring a neuropsychologist, Dr. Laura Janssens, Dr. Skip Brin, and neurofeedback legend, Jay Gunkelman. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. This is an all-star cast that are more than happy to share their knowledge with you. My name is Pete, and today we're going to talk about holiday depression. We got Christmas coming up. We got the New Year's coming up. We have Omicron coming up. Lots to talk about. But before we get to that, we'd like to say, hey, thanks to our Patreon supporters. Outrageous Baking, Tour Talk, EEG and Me, Mara, Sadia M., Jonathan Rowan, January Terrell. And then we have Joshua M. at Alternative Behavioral Therapy out in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Hanukkah to all our Patreon peeps out there. Outrageous Baking is a dedicated gluten-free bakery that has been around for 15 years. Tour Talk wants more people to discover text-to-speech because listening to text can increase efficiency and reduce stress. And if you're in Vancouver, Washington, and you need to get a brain checkup, visit Joshua M. at Alternative Behavioral Therapy Neurofeedback Service in Vancouver, Washington. Okay, guys, we have holiday depression, New Year's coming up, anxiety. Does that ever make the top list of things that psychologists have to deal with, Skip?
Annually.
Yeah.
And I think expectations, it is a common theme and has been, and I'm not joking, you know, for the 25, 30 years I've been in the field, there's, you know, certain expectations around holidays and that they go a certain way and that everybody's joyful and thankful and all those good things. And, you know, then reality kicks in and you're dealing with all kinds of things that go on the other 11 months of the year. And so, you know, keeping expectations in check, and that doesn't mean you can't, you know, be looking forward to, you know, visiting with family and friends and participating in the season, but to, you know, temper things a bit. And that, you know, general approach or just idea around, hey, let's keep expectations in check, what, you know, predates the last couple of years we've had here. And so you can add to, you know, the general air quotes fun that is involved with, you know, family and get togethers and friends and coordinating things and, yeah, Black Friday shopping and all that good stuff with COVID concerns and worries. And, you know, like most families, they're multi-generational. So what do you do when you have, you know, grandma coming over now that folks are allowed to maybe visit a little bit and, you know, who's vaxxed, who's not, who, you know, believes in the vax, who doesn't. And I'm certainly not trying to, you know, go one direction or the other, just pointing out that, hey, we have an entirely different component that's added to gatherings in general, right? But that when we consider maybe some pressures that are already around holiday, you know, expectations, it just magnifies it. And, you know, no kidding, but COVID's magnified most things for the last couple of years. So back to the original question, hey, is there anything that psychologists are talking about? And that is certainly there, you know, tops on the list for the last month and a half, right? Because Thanksgiving is included.
The Omicron, is that passing up COVID or both? Or Jay and I were talking about it before the show.
Specifically, I think it might raise some concerns because it's a variant. And so, hey, how does this actually play out? And then, you know, you're trying to look for some kind of data that supports some position on it. My opinion is that for most of the folks that I'm talking with, it's all the same. It's more COVID. It's more of this giant boulder that's moved into our experience and it's still there. So it, you know, if we want to go trauma and I'm not necessarily introducing it, but if you want to just talk about, you know, the phenomena of trauma, and how you can become re-traumatized, it's basically a remembering or a rejoining of a way that you responded to something that's happening, right? It's more of the same here. So If we call it something else, that's fine. Technically, and if scientists are identifying different strains that, qualify or necessitate calling it something different, that's fine. On my end of the thing, of this, impact is it's more of the same. People are responding to something that is being reacted to, right? Both kind of socially, but also interpersonally in the same manner. Like, hey, do we got to do this distancing thing still? It's just reigniting the practices that were put in place, that, kind of led to these emotional reactions over time. So again, I'm repeating myself, but it's kind of more the same, Pete, right? It's just, it's keeping on, right?
Hey, is it the front left part of the head? Remember, I'm just a layman here, but for the new techs that are coming on, is there something going on in the front left?
We do end up seeing depression as an imbalance frontally, but you don't just have boo-hoo, I'm sad depression. There's also a motivation, lack of initiation as a presentation, and there are agitated depressions. Depending upon the balance between the frontal hemispheres, you end up with a different presentation. But, we have to remember that the virus isn't an invasion from Greece. We've gotten all these Greek letters. We've got half the damn alphabet here. This is, unfortunately, for many, going to end up being a final chapter in their existence. And for a lot of people, it's a near miss. On top of seasonal depression and burnout from the virus and the shutdown of the economy and economic distress and depression, we have seasonal affective depression. And, especially Skip up in Alaska, I mean, there's parts of Alaska that don't see sun for a few months. If you get up far enough north, you don't end up with sun for a while. So seasonal affective disorder ends up being a really major negative influence on mood. You do need to end up having a certain amount of sunlight in order to end up escaping that. And although there are light panels and things like that, there's nothing quite like being able to walk outside, getting hit in the face with a nice bright morning sun and getting out in nature. And unfortunately, knee deep in snow, and I understand that there are some people that are going to end up with roof deep snow over the next few days in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska and Canada. So, getting snowed in is something I grew up with. I grew up in Fargo. I actually went out the second story window one time where to get out of the house, broke into the garage, busting the window to get into the garage because you couldn't open anything, fired up the snowblower and sent it through the drift that had covered the garage door. So, having snow covering the first story of the house was not an unheard of experience in Fargo. So, tis the season to be jolly, but when you got to jump out the second story of the window and bust the window of the garage, it's not exactly the jollies. But the expectation is there. I know many people who have lost people. Anybody that loses somebody anywhere near the holiday is the recollection of the loss, and it's revisited. And as losses fade over time, people get over these things, but they're revisited again and again. So again, 'tis the season. If you can be jolly, so much the better. Feel free to feel the way you feel. Honest emotion should be expressed. Hell, I crack cartoons, so don't. I've tried at the drop of a hat. So any emotion that comes up is absolutely fine to be expressed. You shouldn't feel like you have to squelch an emotion around me, at least.
The people that are depressed about growing older or aging, you got anything for them?
why are you asking Jay that?
Why are you asking me?
It seems like you're piling on or something.
Well, you know, I actually do carry around all sorts of stuff. So
yeah,
let's share a quick run through. What does your brain look like when you're 1 month old?
Ooh.
You know, it's slow. You don't have alpha. You have delta.
And hey, Jay, let me jump in super quick. Like, all right, so that means, you know, you got a 1 month old wired up.
How is that happening?
How's that happening? Who's collecting that data?
This is, in fact, collected by a customer of mine who had the occurrence to hook up a one-month-old for a hospital circumstance. And, you know, it's basically all slow content. Now, and an occasional electrode pop and some slight movement. But you don't expect to see background alpha. And you see transients in it that are, you know, visually kind of exciting, but this is just a 1 month old, you know, pure and simple. And, you know, babies sometimes have febrile seizures or look like they're, you know, something going on, a twitch or something like that. And parents will sometimes bring them into a hospital for an evaluation. This one has essentially normal variation. It's not an abnormal one. It's just a 1 month old, just to see how slow things actually are. Now, we can close that out. Here's a 2 year old, eyes closed, which is always a task for the 2 year old in and of itself.
Right.
But you can see this is 500 microvolts per division here. A centimeter is essentially 500 microvolts. You can see the size of the EEG here. They're starting to get some slightly faster frequencies, but at two, you're not expected to have resting state background alpha posteriorly. This is still delta and now theta. You know, things are maturing, but you still don't have the thalamocortical system wired up and running. But these are important periods of time. You know, in your first year of life, the face-to-face interaction with the parent ends up helping to mature and develop the neurochemistry of the brain. Here's an interesting paper I would suggest, and this is an old version of scanning, that this is essentially Alan Shore from UCLA psychiatry department, and they're talking about the mother and baby face to face and the development of attachment. So attachment disorders, all sorts of important psychopathology potentially being developed by inappropriate face-to-face experience, and the later life development of social emotions. There's some very good literature about development as well. Let's look at the other end of things. Here's a 72-year-old. That's, you know, where'd all the voltage go? Well, this is 70 microvolts is the size of one of these instead of 500 on the 2 year old. There's beta HCZ is a bit of an insomnia issue, but their primary complaint was working memory loss. As you age, you start to kind of lose the ability to remember factoids, name of something, somebody's name, some name of a place, pulling out words that you know, you just can't kind of pull them up. Well, this left frontal and temporal waveform that you see here, this is a slow edge of alpha, left frontal temporally. This is the spot that ends up being necessary for working memory, word finding, verbal fluency. That's the fault in this EEG on top of the insomnia. So where did all the voltage go? Well, as we start to maturationally decline, this is aging, not in a good way. You can end up having localized changes. And again, the waveform that you see left frontal temporal is the sort of waveform that you see back here. This is a slower left frontal temporal feature. Now, some people, when they're aging, end up running into pathology, not just the normal aging, you know, starting to lose a little bit of recall. These are calibrations. They're done at the beginning of medically oriented studies. They show you that the amplifiers are all working the same, that the amplification, how much deviation is equivalent. If you change your filters, the shape of them changes. So the doctor that's looking at it can tell what the filter settings are, and the sharpness of the peak and the how rapid it declines are high frequency and low frequency settings. So as we get into the EEG here, this is somebody who's got cerebrovascular insufficiency. Let me get this into a proper montage. You can see in 1 second here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, just barely in the alpha band. And as we scroll through the EEG, and I'm going to open up the low frequencies here, because this person has a phenomenon called cerebrovascular insufficiency. See this little moment where you've got a delta wave in the temporal areas bilaterally for a few seconds, and then it goes flat for the rest of it? This moment, the brain has got insufficient flow, and the delta that you see in the temporal areas here is an abnormal feature that's consistent with cerebrovascular insufficiency. Now, commonly, that's an irregular heartbeat. You know, if you've got atrial fibrillation, preventricular contractions, PVCs, PATs, Wolff-Parkinson-White. I mean, there's all sorts of cardiac rhythm disturbances that when the heart's not beating properly, it's not pumping properly. And if the pump doesn't work, you don't get it up to the top floor here. So these intermittent episodes of rhythmic slow content in the temporal lobe end up being the correlation with an insufficient supply. Now, there's some big slow sways of eye movement that I've gone by as well, but intermittent temporal rhythmic, very slow delta activity that's gone by in this case a couple of times ends up being the hallmark of cerebrovascular insufficiency. The other thing is, we counted an eight, but and we haven't done any really fancy cleanup, but I'm going to toss up the spectra on this and colorize the spectra in traditional band definitions. The alpha band is in yellow. You can see that the alpha here is sticking into the theta band a little bit. And there's also delta in the temporal areas, and the temporal delta larger on the left side. This is, again, cerebrovascular insufficiency. But the fact that the peak of alpha is okay, but the range of alpha is not. Cognitive decline ends up being seen associated with a slowing of alpha. Roy John at NYU who's, you know, passed, goodness, too many years ago now. Roy basically did a nice study along with Leslie Pritchett in the 1990s, where they looked at the alpha frequency at PZ in aging individuals who were complaining of cognitive impairment, the first blush of something's not right, and they go to the doctor. At that point, if the alpha was still in the alpha band, 2 years later, they were at home with some assistance. But if the peak of the alpha was actually in the theta band, 2 years later, they were in full care. And you can see the tip of the alpha over here is at 7.81, just a hair outside of the alpha band. And this slower alpha in the temporal area, again, that's where the peak is over here, suggests that there's a decline going on here. Again, as you have cerebrovascular insufficiency, the brain is going to slow due to degradation. I mean, it needs blood flow to maintain healthy cellular function. And this brain is slightly slow. It's on its way towards cognitive impairment. And the cerebrovascular insufficiency suggests that the supply line is either being interrupted by a bad rhythm, or the carotid and vertebral basilar arteries may be impaired with some flow dynamics not right. But at this point, we need to end up looking outside of the brain to make sure that the blood supply and cardiac function are adequate. Now, they have lifeline screenings. You can get a carotid ultrasound and a vertebral basilar ultrasound and ultrasound of the heart. And they'll check with a Doppler to make sure you got good flow through your legs and stuff. And it's fairly inexpensive. They do it as a commercial service, as maybe 25 minutes of a text time. They put some goop on the end of a ultrasound probe and scan using Doppler. They can measure the flow really quite precisely. So cerebrovascular insufficiency is another one of the kinds. Now, this is looking at gender differences. This is age, you know, across the bottom. So this is 4 or 5 years old on up to 18 years old. So this is the developmental trajectory. These are different EEG clusters. And you can see the difference between male and female. So cluster two is a particular EEG feature. And these are the EEG frequencies. This is the age of the patient. And you can see at specific ages, there's a significant difference between male and female, and at what frequency it's at. There's an alpha and beta difference in the early teens that differentiates males and females. There's slow content and fast content that differentiate in the alpha and gamma and beta content. So again, the male and female are not the same through the developmental trajectory from age 5 to 18. And we also have at this point, we've got an anoxic coma. So when it's no longer working at all, and you've slipped into a coma, the flattening and then the bursting happens. The anoxic coma has created a toxic or metabolic encephalopathy. And these are called triphasic waves, up, down, and widespread triphasics. This is, again, a toxic or metabolic encephalopathy. The bursts and then suppression that you see, flattening and then bursting and then flattening and then bursting. The burst suppression type pattern like this augurs a grave prognosis. Basically, this is kind of a pattern you see shortly before you end up in a grave. So we've got EEGs from birth to just prior to death. I didn't pull out a flatline EEG. They're not terribly dynamic. They're just kind of flat. I suggest that there's also a very nice new document out showing male and female difference as well as age. That's a review of the Korean database that has been gathered. This publication is a brand new publication. It's just out, 17th of December. So this is science so fresh, it's still fresh. Hot, you know?
Yeah,
Frontiers in Neuroscience. And this is basically a full description of the database that they collected. They collected the data for over a decade. Doctors Kim and Kang are the two principals involved in this. And then obviously other folks have done a lot of the write-up here as well. So you can look at the detail of how they've constructed their database. It's extremely well done. They did not cut any corners. There's a lot of kids, under 10 years old. There's a lot of kids in their teens. And the total number of people in the groups drops down because there's less maturational change through the developmental years here. There's a lot of change here. So you need more people in each small group in order to characterize the developmental trajectory in these very young years. But here's male and female, young group and adult. And here's the differences, p-values. Look at the females and the EEGs here and the males and the EEGs here in the adult group. Adult male and female, although, you know, there's some stuff at the top of the head here, there's a dramatic difference between the two, and statistically, it's extremely significant. So, all of the databases that said, well, they look the same, so we combined them. Well, they don't look the same. I wouldn't combine them. I advised the Koreans as they were going into this process well over a decade ago now, that they should keep their male and female data separate, because we know there's a difference in the brain structure, the symmetry between hemispheres, the extent of the corpus callosum, males should have callosal envy, females have a well-developed corpus callosum, and males have a spindly little thing. So we really do have now the ability to differentiate male and female that we did not have before in a quantitative way. And it's a shame we didn't have it, because there are significant differences. Here in the development, the upper line is a female, the lower line is male. This is the means and standard deviation scatter. Delta in a very young age is high, and as you mature, it drops down. Here's theta starting very high, dropping down. Alpha starting a bit lower, peaking around 10 years old or so, puberty, pre-puberty, where your voltages are big, and then it drops down across age. Beta similarly rises up, drops down, and then it goes back up as you age. The fast activity ends up increasing with age. Going down, going down, going down, going up. And females dramatically more. Now, the gamma in females is also really dramatically different than males. So this is just a glimpse at their database. These are norms for different clinical groups. I would urge you to go ahead and look at the publication. This is the newest normative database that's out there, and it meets a very high level of scientific scrutiny. And again, this is fully published in all the detail of how they collected things, what the criteria were, even after people's data was collected, they actually excluded some because of outlier findings. So this is an extremely well-constructed normative reference database that keeps male and female and age all segregated. So I'd urge you to take a solid look at this. Again, brand new publications, Frontiers in Neuroscience. Anyway, that's the kind of stuff I pulled up on aging, and I figured it was probably well worth looking at. Remember, as you age, treat those who are older and younger with care, because the ones that are older already have the experience you're going through, and the younger ones will get there at some point. So don't be too hard on anyone.
Jay, I have a question, and I'll try to synthesize it as I go along here. It includes a few things that you mentioned, and then some others that I just thought of, right, that popped into my head. So when you showed the study from 96 and the scan, pre-digital gathering of data, right? It just reminded me of some things from back in those days. And I remember a study that was passed around literally, in grad school. And it was on the association between colic and sociopathy or any social behaviors. And, correlation, not causation, of course, but the idea of the study was, and the folks in the study were convicted, felons of certain crimes. And so, it's folks that had been in prison. And so they qualified for a lot of reasons for diagnoses of antisocial behavior patterns, right? And so they got a chance to talk to those folks and then got a chance to connect with their families and mothers in particular. And so, yes, there was a preponderance of colic. The idea here was that there's something that happens in early development and connection that when you have something like colic, which basically results in a repulsion of connection, right? And then mothers were having difficulties accessing their motherliness, right? Because you got this baby that you can't soothe, all your best tricks just aren't working. And ultimately it led to frustrations. And I'm simplifying like crazy, but you can probably get the picture here that if there's an infant that can't be soothed and a mother that is just burnt out because everything she's trying is not working, they have this separation, right? So yeah, that was the conclusion. And so there was just a lot of discussion around this phenomena that happened, and it's slightly chicken or egg, right? In that, hey, is there colic and potential for antisocial behaviors because of neuroanatomical development or, ability to develop or not develop, right? Yeah. And so it's which end of that? So all this is leading to kind of a question to you, but, and hopefully a discussion and maybe another show at some point, but this early connection development and what that fosters, and I am referring to mirror neurons and just that ability to, incorporate these cares that are given, safety and nurturance and all these things that allow our brains to maybe settle on a little bit and do other things instead of continually trying to scan the environment for these fundamental needs. So I'm hoping we can discuss just how that process happens. But then since you brought up the gender differences, all of the people in this study were males. And so there are females that are diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder or sociopathy, back in the day, but it's different, right? It's different probably for social reasons and the way males are trained to behave and women not. So there's just another area of potential discussion if you want, but mostly I'm wondering what you might be able to add to this early period, 0 to 2 maybe, of connection and what happens neuroanatomically that's important for us as a species.
Well, I have to say that Alan Shore's work ends up detailing in almost painful detail that entire process. You know, the face-to-face mother or father and baby end up triggering the mirror neuron, which, you know, if the baby makes a face, the parents mimic it back, and the babies start to learn emotion. And if you don't have that mirror neuron engagement, you can end up not understanding emotion. So, and there's a critical period, the first year or so, your primary emotions end up getting learned. Now, social emotion, shame and guilt are learned a little later. Most of your primary emotion ends up having a right frontal development, but those are primary emotions. You're built in with some emotions. Fear is one of them. If you have a baby and they have what's called a visual cliff, they're on a glass top, and there's a solid piece underneath the glass, and there's an edge where it drops away. Well, the baby won't crawl across the visual cliff. I mean, you know, there's a certain amount of they perceive innately that that's not a safe thing to go over the cliff. If you put a snaky, wiggly thing, they revulse back. It's not just an item of interest. They actually have innate fear of snakes, as do a lot of animals. So we've got some built-in fear. The primary emotions do end up getting inculcated with the mother or father face-to-face with the infant. They also soothe the infant face-to-face. They perceive the emotion. So they train emotion, they help stabilize, and they literally trigger the neurochemical development of the right frontal neural networks. And Alan Shore details that in, again, almost painful detail. It's not an easy read, but it's a damn good read. I do suggest going through his work carefully. It's not, like I say, don't sit down and expect to breeze through it in a few hours. You'll read a page and scratch your head and look back at it and go, what was that? You know, oh, you catch it second time through, it'll all click, you know. So this is one to ponder. But social emotion of shame and guilt basically end up being determined also by face-to-face contact. If the infant is shunned, that they can't re-establish the face-to-face relationship, it's disturbing to them. And again, that's learned at a next level up in age 2-3, where you actually have to learn the social emotion. So shame and guilt ends up actually being learned left temporally, not right frontally. So he'll go through all of that in all of his work, but I would suggest that it's a good read for people who want to learn about attachment, how it's developed, how it can go awry, and also to a certain extent, how to step in and repair some of this. And that's not easy. Critical periods when they're missed in development sometimes can't be recovered. And the work I've seen in psychopaths in prison end up showing right frontal problems in the EEG, quite often a slow feature right frontally. So if that area doesn't develop, you may never have the ability to have normal emotional relationships, and you may end up being a psychopath. So Shore's work is critical. And nowadays we have all sorts of attachment therapy that's been developed, really solidly developed on the neuroscience. Bessel van der Kolk's work, he's a psychiatrist and has focused on developmental trauma and attachment. and the medical underpinnings of it. So I would suggest that at this point, if somebody has an attachment problem, there are actually well-developed therapies that end up having good efficacy. And because of Bessel, neurofeedback is part of that repertoire. I mean, he's popularized the use of neurofeedback as a tool within the attachment repair therapeutic world. So, there's a lot of folks that are working in that area. Some of the development has been without the assistance of EEG/QEG, but at the same time, there's solid EEG/QEG evidence, and Bessel has started to focus the attachment and affect repair world on neurofeedback as a tool. So anyway, it's an exciting application because you can really dramatically change the outcome of a life. Years ago, I worked with a therapist. Unfortunately, he died in a car accident before he could publish, but we presented his outcome data at an ISNR, or I think maybe SNR, SSNR, one of the versions of the society's name. With 97 people, so it was not a small study, all reactive attachment disorder. So these are kids who had a difficult start, and now they can't form an attachment bond, and they're like a small hand grenade thrown into a school. You know, they're going to make the classroom that they're in a total chaotic mess. So the school systems don't want them in the school system. And Larry Van Bloom, who was controversial, he did something called holding, like they squeezed to stabilize and calm. And that does work. Yeah, it does work, but you can do it excessively. You know, you get Pete laying on a kid, and the little kid's going to get kind of like not able to breathe. So you've got to watch what's going on with holding therapy. And it was controversial, but at the same time, he had lots of other techniques. He did two or three neurofeedback sessions a day in his little home school, and every rad kid in the entire county was sent to his little home school. And when he got a new one in, he would assign them two or three neurofeedback sessions a day. Now, it took 120, 150 sessions to get them stable, but you weren't doing sleep in between sessions. So the numbers really are a bit different. People using the same technique, but doing office visits instead of having a school where they could do multiple per day. And he wasn't charging per session. So it wasn't like he was, ripping money away from the county by doing the training.
This was part of the curriculum.
This part, he was paid to school them, not to do neurofeedback. So, but the people got about 60 to 80 sessions, about like an autistic kid training duration for people using his technique, but in an office type setting. We found 93% of those 97 kids had an anterior cingulate and a right temporal change in the EEG. And the right temporal changes like the PTSD and Asperger's E traits that we see, social perception, and the anterior cingulate was the perseverative, over-focus, obsessive compulsive trait that they had as well. And again, he died, unfortunately, in a nasty car accident shortly after we presented that data. So it didn't end up getting written up into a journal. But it was quite effective. And we see other people working with attachment having the same kind of efficacy. They're also working in the right temporoparietal area, like Larry had found. So if there's a kid that has an attachment problem, there is a positive outcome therapy available. You just have to have a therapist that's familiar with the approach.
The 72-year-old, how do you address dementia with quote-unquote brain brightening? I know we only have a few minutes left, but I'm just curious if you could point to it.
In fact, brain brightening as a term was coined by seniors who experienced Tom Baczynski's work in a project called the Ponce de Leon Project in Florida. Ponce de Leon, looking for the Fountain of Youth, Florida. Anyway, apparently there's maybe some people still looking for it there. So, but we basically end up trying to slightly speed up the background alpha. If you train SMR-related frequencies, not centrally, but central parietally, the parietal aspect of that ends up being faster alpha frequencies. Following the training, the seniors coined the term brain brightening. Now, what you're actually doing is changing how many samples per second they're taking of the outside world, your alpha packets perception. So if your alpha is at 7-8, you're taking 7 or 8 little snapshots of the outside world. That's not great resolution. If you speed it up to 10, 11, 12, the faster edge of alpha, you have a much higher resolution. So you see things crisper because it's higher resolution. You see things, colors are brighter. Memory works. You don't have retrieval problems for words and factoids. So the tip of the tongue phenomenon goes away. Now, his work was back in the 1980s. It was replicated more recently, quite effectively, by Christine Palmquist for her doctoral dissertation. Got a good replication. She actually did QEG pre-post and found the speeding up of alpha was the effect, and that it was an effective brain brightening for the seniors who were involved in the study. You know, I can imagine some Del Webb development somewhere out there kind of listening in the background going, maybe we should set up a neurofeedback, center in the Del Webb. I mean, they have all the exercise facilities, shops for metal, shops for wood. They have, everything set up for the seniors. Why not set up a brain brightening thing in your Del Webb Center and have the people who, and they have memory things happening in the Del Webb Centers as well. So, it's a perfect match. There's really good outcomes. And I'm surprised that we don't see, senior center, EEG centers popping up as little tiny franchises or something. If somebody does that, they don't have to pay me for the idea because, it's a zeitgeist. It's an idea whose time has come. The technology exists. We've got reasonable hardware. It's not overly expensive. I mean, the first QEG machine I got was $165,000. You could buy a dozen of them for that now. So,
How many trainings for the seniors?
Well, it depends upon where they're starting and how severe their circumstance is. But you usually get a fairly solid brain brightening effect and an assistance with the quality of sleep starting in the mid-20s, 23, 25. Sessions, you see significant clinical benefit, but if you have a very severe circumstance with they've lost more capacity than somebody next to them, it's going to take a bit longer with them. But what else do you have to do if you're at a Del Webb Center?
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a session today. It's something to get out and go do, So it isn't like an inconvenience. Oh, shoot, I've got to squeeze one more appointment in.
If you do the initial training, how often do you have to go back?
One of the nice things about neurofeedback is that once you've really got it, you've got it. It's like riding a bicycle. I don't know how many years it's been since you've been on a bike, but your father isn't going to have to run along holding the seat next to you. Well, my father's gone. I mean, if he had to hold a seat, I would never be on a bike again. But, you might not be riding with no hands right away like you used to, but you're going to get there real quick. You don't lose the skill you've learned. It's good if you continue to use it, you're going to stay really quite good at it. If you've been on a bike fairly regularly, you don't have to learn how to ride it anymore. So, you know, and the studies on neurofeedback with 6-month follow-up and 12-month follow-up show actually enhanced skill set. You intake to outtake, you know, they've gotten this much better. And you think, well, 6 months from now, it'll get a little bit worse. It'll regress a little bit more like it was in the beginning. No. Remember, your dad ran along with the bike and finally he let go and you were riding, but you weren't really good on a bike then. You were just barely able to stand up, stay upright. 2 months later, you're jumping curbs, you know, putting stuff in the spokes to make it sound like a motorcycle, you know, riding with no hands, showing off. By 6 month or 12 month follow-up, people are riding with no hands and showing off. They're not back to halfway how they were in the beginning, still needing somebody to kind of stand there holding the bike up. They've got the skill. And neurofeedback gives you a skill. It's not like a massage where you've got to go back and get another massage. And nothing against massage. I mean, they're fabulous. But you don't go home with a new skill. You go home with a very nice effect. But... you know, life sets back in and pretty soon that old knot in the shoulder comes back and you got to go for another massage. Well, there wasn't a skill learned. It was a treatment, not a training. Neurofeedback is a training, not a treatment. Now, it can be combined with stimulation technology. There's some treatment and training both at the same time in those circumstances. You wouldn't have to keep going back necessarily once you've got a good new skill. For people who are trying to forestall dementia, on the other hand, you should continue to do the treatment. They're on a downhill decline. You can forestall further decline with treatment, but if you stop the treatment, there's a precipitous decline. So if they're in process of, you know, losing their marbles, as they say, if you've got progressive loss of cognitive function with dementia, you can forestall further loss, but you're probably not going to fully normalize, but you can forestall further loss and kind of get them in a holding pattern. And, if you can catch them early enough, you can maintain more function. If you catch it really late, you can kind of get a holding pattern, but you're probably not going to normalize anybody at that point.
Thank you all for listening to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast. We'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, Outrageous Baking, Tor Talk, EEG and Me, Mara, Sadia M, and Jonathan Rowan, January Terrell. Outrageous Baking is a dedicated gluten-free bakery that has been around for 15 years. And Tor Talk wants more people to discover text-to-speech because listening to text can increase efficiency and reduce stress. Hey, don't forget Joshua M. at Alternative Behavioral Therapy, neurofeedback service in Vancouver, Washington, neurofeedbackcare.com. Hey, do you have an idea for a topic? Please email Pete at neuronoodle.com or leave us a voicemail and link in the podcast notes. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And hey, if you really, really like us, you can always buy us a coffee on Patreon/neuronoodle. We love our Patreon peeps, don't we, Jay?
Absolutely.
Hey, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Holidays. Cue the music.